grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. The Dudes and Beer Podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, still coming at you from Austin, Texas. The world is slowly rebooting as I hear about AV jobs around the country. So, very much looking forward to a stream that I have coming up in Pennsylvania. Cannot wait to go do that. As the world reboots, we see crazy things in the news all the time. We'll be getting into some of the news of the week here in just a minute. But amongst the craziness, I want to thank all of you guys out there for tuning in for over the last 5 years. People like my wife, people like Julie Connolly, Stephen Bishop, even my brother Randy Jordan out there for supporting the show, being on the show, helping the show out, you know, in the ways that they have over the years to help us get to the point. And especially guests like Mike Turber, John Hall, stuff like that, who, when that pivot for the show really happened, helped us out so much with any time that we'd text. They were like, yeah, man, let's do a show. So it's been great to mature and get to the point where we are now, where we are having guests like our guest this evening, David S. Brody, Boston Globe best-selling author and author of Cabal of the Westford Knight. He is a researcher into the world of the Knights Templar. He is the former director of the New England Antiquities Research Association. So, as somebody who writes fiction, I mean, his works are fiction, no doubt, but they're actively based on real research. They are actively based on real places, real stuff, real happenings, real artifacts that have been found along the way, real theories that are out there. So it's really interesting to see this twist being put on things. We are going to be talking with David S. Brody tonight about his book, about his series of books, and about his years of research into the Templars here in North America. Amazing stuff coming up. Before we get started on all that, let's check out the Dudes and Beer News of the Week. Hop on over to the Dudes and Beer Facebook group. That's where you will find it. Great conversations over there. It's really fantastic. I honestly just got a comment the other day from somebody about how over the period of COVID, they have been so impressed to see not only this community grow and the conversations grow and people's rapiers clinking and going against each other from different points of view and different walks of life and different political points of view. But nobody calls each other names. Nobody digs into, like, just horrible bloodletting like they do on other groups and stuff like that. So thank you guys for that. In the news of the week, we have the U.S. military poisoning communities across the U.S. with toxic chemicals out of The Guardian, as well as Duante White, the shooting there, the Brooklyn city manager, was fired after calling for due process of the police officer involved in the shooting. There is a man in the hospital after receiving his Johnson & Johnson vaccine with some horrid side effects of blood clotting, things like that. Numerous states have pulled that vaccine because of the issues going on. Joe Biden is looking to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan by September. Echo, 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 echo. We have heard this before. We'll see if it happens. And oddly enough, just before the election, we had passed the first year in 20 years where a U.S. Army or military personnel had not been killed in Afghanistan. So it'll be nice to see everybody come home after, half my life almost. The suspect in the Tennessee high school shooting was apparently a student at the high school. An officer who fatally shot Dwayne Wright, the police chief, has resigned in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. So, and of course, they were getting into the fact that the officer involved in that shooting was training a rookie at the time of the shooting. So just some of the news of the week going on over there on the Dudes and Beer Facebook group. We hop on over, join the conversation, follow the page. That's where you will get all the updates. That's where you'll get all the updates for guests, things like that. If you really want all the updates, folks, hop on over to the Dudes and Beer website. Dudesandbeer.com is where you can go. Dudesandbeer.com/app is where you can go. There's also a link right on our homepage in the widgets, but dudesandbeer.com/app, you can download the official Dudes and Beer app and not only listen live, but you can chat in questions beforehand. There's a chat area just for conversation, like what's on the Facebook group. There's even a tip calculator, as well as access to our knowledge vault. All of our declassified documents, things like that, that we talk about and show on air. How do I get it? Dudesandbeer.com/app is the website. Click the big image of the Android in the middle, and you'll see a little pop-up that says, save the APK file. Go to your downloads, open that file, and install it. Literally, when you click on it, it's like, install now. We have decided not to put it on the app markets. We have numerous people in our group that are not members of the Google market, things like that. We have not found anybody to turn it into an Orchard service yet. So sorry, Orchard dwellers, right now it is for Android users only. Feel free to stop on by dudesandbeer.com/app to grab that, everybody. And, while you're online checking that out, let's get into things real quick. Hop on by TrueHempScience.com. That is our latest sponsor. Great guys over there. Christopher Lynch over at True Hemp Science is amazing. I've been working with him for a couple years to get things going, and with working with us here at the network, and like the products they have are amazing. I've traveled the country. You guys know I'm into some alternative things in my lifestyle. But CBD is one of those things that is on my recommend list from my doctor for my anxiety. So I use it every day. And True Hemp Science is some of the best that I have found around. Christopher Lynch has spent years developing this product and has spent the time and research to come up with a whole plant extract, not just the leaves, not just the buds, not just like the leavens in the stems or the stalk or the roots, the whole plant, so that you get a full spectrum of CBD benefits. Amazing terpene levels. One of my favorites is the number 64, actively only available locally because of its need for refrigeration. But you can see there the red color of it. Man, that's the suspended cinnamon and other Ayurvedic herbs that they use for some of their blends. And it's great. It's fantastic stuff. Use the code DUDE7 and you will save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more, as well as getting 50 grams of edibles, either cookies or brownies. So you get two edibles and 7% off your whole cart of $50 or more when you use the code DUDES7. When we come back from this message from Podcast Cadet, we will be talking with our guest, David S. Brody, author of Cabal of the Westward Night, Templars at the Newport Tower, right after this from Podcast Cadet. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies.
Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com.
That's right, folks. Stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. Full disclosure, I am Chris Jordan. I am one of the owners of Podcast Cadet. The whole reason I started that was to be able to help people get the advice that they need. So many people get advice from folks that may not be the best industry advice. So to be able to start that up, to be able to help out with that, I think was really important for myself and for those that I work with in the industry. Our guest this evening, I've been very excited about. His book arrived a couple days ago, and I've been reading through it. David S. Brody, former director of the New England Antiquities Research Association, as well as Boston Globe best-selling author. Welcome to the show. How are you today, sir?
Doing great, Chris. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to a fun conversation. I'm sure we'll get deep into Templar stuff and wish we had more time.
Oh, man, absolutely. The concept of Templars in North America is something that I have been fascinated with for years. I have been more than impressed with the fact that my wife is addicted to the show Curse of Oak Island, which, of course, that's one of the going theories, is that perhaps it was the Templars who came and deposited treasures at Oak Island,
right?
Things like that. So, before we get started, I love, like I told you before the show, I love getting into the bona fides of my guests, especially folks like you who spent time as a lawyer in their life, because it basically means whenever you're doing your research, you're looking at it with different eyes and with a different concept than a lot of people are, whether you're a true believer or not, you know? And in addition to that, yeah, so it's the fact of you have no vested interest in lying.
It's funny that you say that. Like, as a lawyer, I would never lie. So the implication there, but I think you said it a little tongue in cheek. So I'm not gonna be offended by that. But seriously, it does give me a unique perspective, because I've been trained, you know, as a lawyer to analyze and critique and weigh and parse and even dismiss and rebut evidence. You know, for me, it's all about evidence. And so I come at this, you know, some people come at it from a scientific point of view, some people come at it from a religious point of view, some people come at it from an idea that the government's hiding stuff from us, conspiracy point of view. For me, it's all coming at it from the point of view of, where does the evidence lead? Because there is evidence, there are artifacts and sites in North America that seem to indicate the Templars were here. And so if that's not the story that evidence tells, what is the story? So there is a story. I think it happens to be, yes, the Templars are here in America before Columbus. If you think I'm wrong, that's fine. Tell me what the story is that you think is right, and we can talk about it. But it's not enough for you just to say, oh, no, the evidence doesn't exist, I'm going to stick my head in the sand and pretend that it's not there. That doesn't do it for me. And so I do think that as a lawyer and as someone trained to look at evidence, that does give me a sort of a unique way to approach this problem. We'll talk about the evidence as we go along tonight. But to me, that's how I first came upon it, is, look, there's a story here, and I want to know what it is. And no one's explained it to me adequately yet, so I'm going to go look at it myself.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, to know that you, as a former lawyer, like you were saying, look at it with those specific eyes, and are willing to, yes, explore options that perhaps scholars are not willing to explore whenever you look at things like the Newport Tower in Rhode Island, things like that.
Well, yeah, and so... Right, so scholars oftentimes have, you know, if you're an archaeologist, you know about stuff that comes out of the ground. If you're a historian, you know about stuff written in old books. If you're a geologist, you know about rocks. If you're a cartographer, you know about maps. But people oftentimes are isolated in their field of study and don't take sort of a broader liberal arts perspective or viewpoint of things. And so, to me, if you're going to answer these questions, like, you know, you mentioned the Newport Tower. The Newport Tower, you can't explain what it is if you're only going to look at it from an archaeological point of view, because there's so much more to it than that. So, you know, the joke about, you know, parents don't let your kids go get a liberal arts education, well, once in a while it comes in handy. And this is one of those times, because to look at something like the Newport Tower, which is a Romanesque-style round stone tower in Newport, Rhode Island, that the mainstream historians tell us is colonial, built during the Puritan time period, as if the Puritans would have any reason to build a Romanesque-style tower. Like, it just makes no sense. But to understand that, you have to look at it, because there's evidence architectural evidence. There's evidence relating to the fireplace, the unit of measure that was used to build it. There is archaeological evidence. There is evidence related to ancient maps. There's a whole bunch of different disciplines that we can use to look at the tower, and with that evidence and looking at it through different prisms, we come to the conclusion, in my mind, that there's no way that it's a colonial windmill, which is what they say it is, and therefore it must be something else. It's older than that. It was built by a different culture. It wasn't built by the English because, for example, the unit of measure is a Scottish L, and it wasn't built as a windmill because, for example, there's a fireplace on the second floor, and you would never have an active mill where you have flame, because you'd have a combustible event. It would just explode. And just stuff like that. So what is it? And you start looking at the tower itself. The group I belong to, you mentioned it, New England Antiquities Research Association. One of our members recently led an archaeological dig there, and they were able to find some mortar. An ancient mortar was made with seashells, because seashells have lime, and there was a piece of a seashell there, and they sent that seashell to Woods Hole Oceanographic Society for carbon dating, and the date came back early 1400s. So that's a piece of evidence that we have to use in understanding the tower. You know, we can't just throw that away and say, well, that doesn't really make it, it doesn't fit our theory. That piece of evidence has to be used. So stuff like that, when we look at the tower, the intersection point of all the various pieces of evidence, in my opinion, indicates late 1300s, built by a gentleman by the name of Prince Henry Sinclair, who was a Scotsman. He was Norse on his mother's side. His family descended from the outlawed Knights Templar, and so that's how we sort of get the Templar connection to the Newport Tower in the late 1300s, about 100 years before Columbus. And, you know, again, the Templars are outlawed in 1307, so it's not the active Templars. These are the Templar families, just like when we outlawed the Mafia with the Rico statutes back in the 1960s. The Mafia didn't disappear. They just went underground. So same thing with the Templars. They didn't disappear. Some of them went to jail. Some of them were killed. Most of them fled and went underground and then redefined themselves, reorganized themselves as the Freemasons, as the Knights of Christ in Portugal. But many of them ended up coming over here to America to, you know, get into their treasure, but to hide their treasure from the church.
And how did they, because now, granted, of course, the traditional history would teach us that Columbus discovered America.
Even that, we all learned that, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. We all learned that in second grade. But we also learned, at least I did, that the Norse came to northern Canada, northern Newfoundland, to a place called Lonsdale Meadows, and that was in the early parts of the 11th century. And I guess that doesn't really count because it's so far north, you know. And I know you said, Chris, you lived in Maine, but this is really far north.
Oh, yeah. And then, that's like Nova Scotia north.
That's even further.
Yeah.
North of Nova Scotia is Newfoundland, and on the northern tip of Newfoundland is where the Solanso Meadows site is. And that was discovered in the 1960s. But since then, most historians in Canada now agree that Solanso Meadows was not the Vinland settlement that people used to think it was, but instead was a stopping off point, and that Vinland was further south. In fact, that Vinland probably was in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, perhaps Maine. And so even the experts in Canada now concede that hundreds of years before Columbus, the Norse were down in New England, basically Maine. Okay, so once we get that far, once we sort of kick down that door, and I mentioned Prince Henry Sinclair being a Scotsman on his father's side, but on his mother's side was Norse. And so is it really hard to believe that Sinclair or other Norse who descended from people who came here, came to New England, came to Maine, that they would have never come back again? Or is it more likely that at some point over the next 500 years between, 1009 and 1492, that they did come back? To me, it'd be more surprising if they never came back than it would be that they did. But here's the thing. Unlike Columbus, they had a vested interest in keeping it quiet. They were trading, they were fishing, they were harvesting. They didn't want other people to know about the economic advantages they were finding here, so they kept it quiet. And so that's really the big difference. But the whole idea of Columbus being the first person across, it just doesn't make any sense. And in fact, if you ask the Native Americans, I've become very friendly with some Native Americans here in New England, they just sort of laugh at that, because their oral history is, way before Columbus, the Templars were here, the Norse were here.
Yeah.
We have a memory of that as well.
Well, especially whenever I want to say it, and I may be wrong here, is it the Micmacs?
Exactly, yeah.
Whose Micmac coat of arms is basically the Templar cross.
Exactly. They've got that's excellent. So the Micmac, the legend of Prince Henry Sinclair is that in 1398 he came across with about 10 boats, 10 and his men, and they spent the first winter with the Mi'kmaq tribe, like you said. And as you said, the Mi'kmaq flag is essentially the Templar flag. It's a mirror image of one another. So
it's in reverse. It's a white field with a red cross.
Exactly. So how did that happen? Is that just a coincidence? No. I mean, obviously there was some kind of knowledge transmitted back and forth. Sinclair then continued on the next year after spending the winter with the Mi'kmaq further down the coast into Maine, into Massachusetts, and this is where I sort of entered the picture. I lived for a number of years, 20 years, in a town called Westford, in north of Boston, and it's this Westford night carving, which is a tourist site there. But essentially, what it is that Sinclair and his men came up the Merrimack River inland to the highest hill in eastern Massachusetts, which is in Westford. While climbing the hill, one of their men, his name was, we believe, Gunn, died, and to memorialize his death, they carved an effigy of a knight into the rock ledge. And that effigy is still visible today. You can still go up there and you can very clearly see the battle sword pecked into the rock, and the rest of him, his head and shoulders and shield, have sort of faded away over the centuries. And there's a rubbing, I think, that you posted on your website showing that. But that's the legend of the Westford Knight. And again, that's the story of Sinclair coming across the North Atlantic, following the footsteps of his ancestors, the Norse, coming down the coast, Maine. There's a runic inscription in the area called Spirit Pond, Maine. Again, his mother being a Norse, he would have been versed in runic. The Westford Knight carving in Massachusetts, a Newport Tower we talked about in Rhode Island, another runic carving in Narragansett Bay called the Narragansett Runestone in Rhode Island, another carved stone in Westford near the Westford Knight, stone of a carving of a medieval ship called the Nore, about a mile upriver from where the Westford Knight carving was found. And the good thing about this, it's called the Boatstone. The good thing about this Boatstone carving is we're able to shift this carving out to a geologist in Minnesota by the name of Scott Walter, who many of your listeners probably know of as the host of America on Earth.
Yeah.
And Scott was able to do his forensic geology work, his weathering analysis, and he determined that the carved areas in that stone had been outside in a weathering environment for about 600 years. And that gets us right back to our 1398-1399 date that we think Sinclair was here. So that it's good to have some science behind this theory. And one of the most important things we've been doing over the past, I've been doing this for 14 years now, is trying to get science behind these theories. You know, hard science, not just theory and not just, you know, Native American oral history, that's important, and cartography, that's important, but really hard science, carbon dating with the mortar, the seashell, yeah. This kind of weathering analysis. We're doing some things called optically stimulated luminescence testing. We'll get into that later.
Great.
But you know, getting hard science behind this.
Well, and it's interesting because whenever you look at shows like Curse of Oak Island, and I mean, of course, the show and the reason for the show is like there's these dudes hunting for a treasure, but at the same time, it is the fact that they are they are literally changing history. When you go through and watch the show and see the things that they are discovering on this place that they were like, for years, people have said that nothing happened there before this date. Like, they're finding roads, they're finding remnants of docks, all kinds of stuff. Which, if you're making a dock, that means you're coming there with regularity. And whenever you start, like we had Dennis Stone on, the owner of America's Stonehenge, right up the road from you. Great guy.
Sure. Yeah.
And I was always disappointed living right up there in Maine that I never got to go to that. And to know that when the settlers came to the local area, the Indians had stories about moving to the area and finding the structure. Like, they didn't build it. They didn't build stone structures.
Right, so the America Stonehenge site, that's a really good example. So, and that gets into what I was talking about a few seconds ago with the science. So America Stonehenge, it's a fascinating site. I was just up there a couple weeks ago for the spring equinox. And I spent a lot of time with Dennis Stone. And so that's a good example. It's good to take a minute to talk about that, because the three possibilities as to who built America Stonehenge, the mainstream historians will tell you that it's a colonial root cellars and potato caves, and it was colonial farmers who did all this stuff. That's one theory. A second theory is the Native Americans built it. And then the third theory is some kind of early Mediterranean, pre-Columbus Mediterranean culture came across for whatever reason. So with using science, we've completely eliminated the colonial possibility, because the optically stimulated luminescence testing that we've done there, we did a bunch of it back in September, and we've got preliminary results, and haven't been published yet or anything, but they conclusively prove that it's pre-colonial, okay, pre-1600.
Sure.
So it can't be. There's lots of reasons why we know it can't be the colonists, but now we know it scientifically. So now they're out, they're gone. So now we're down to two possibilities. And although the Native Americans occasionally did do some stone construction, and you know that they were able to pile stones, look how hard is that? But we've brought a couple of the local Native American tribal chiefs up there and toured the site with them, and they basically say, this is an interesting site, but we didn't do this. You know, this is not the kind of thing that we would have done. And if you go up there on the solstices and the equinoxes and the celebrations, there's zero Native American presence there. And you would contrast that to other Native American historical sites, which they are very protective of, understandably so, and they're very aware of, and they treasure it, those sacred sites. You know, they don't just forget about their sacred sites, but they seem to have forgotten about this one, and the reason they forgot about it is because it wasn't theirs to begin with. And so they've made that clear. So now it's not colonial. We've proven it scientifically. It's not Native American. So now we have to open our minds to the third possibility, some kind of ancient Mediterranean or European culture probably came over here and built this. And now we just have to figure out who it was. But, you know, until we have the hard science to knock the colonists out of the game, it was hard to get archaeologists to even open their mind to the possibility. We're up there in September, and Chris, you'll appreciate this because I know you hate nothing more than closed-minded people just like I do. The state archaeologist from New Hampshire was there. He'd been working in the state archaeology office for more than 20 years. This was his first time at the site.
That explains
and the only
a
reason
lot.
He was there was because he wanted to see this new technology in action. But he had refused all these years to go visit what, to me, the most important historical site in New Hampshire. So it's a small state. It's not like Texas. It's a tiny state.
Yeah.
And to live 20 miles away from the site and never be there because you've already decided that it's not important because you've sort of doctrinally been trained to think this way. That just doesn't do it for me. That just shows a lack of intellectual rigor that
Absolutely.
We just can't have from our leaders. That doesn't do it, you know.
Well,
we need to be open-minded.
Well, precisely. And we need to be ready to be wrong. It's okay.
Oh, God forbid. God forbid somebody should say I was wrong.
It's
yeah,
okay if we were wrong, even scientifically. You know, like, good Lord, we're getting ready to... They just announced that there's quite possibly another state of matter. You know? CERN created matter from light. It's possible.
Yep,
they said for years
right.
It wasn't.
Yep. Yeah, and so, you know, you learn, like I said, you learn nothing from being right. I may be wrong, in which case I'm happy to learn my lessons from it. But trying to keep an open mind, trying to follow the science,
yep.
trying to follow the evidence, trying to figure this out. Again,
yeah.
I'm happy to say I might be wrong, but oh my gosh, to never having even been there to look at it with your own two eyes and to dismiss it out of hand without even an examination. I mean, come on.
That is literally called ignorance. That is willful ignorance,
exactly.
And the thing is, ignorance, folks, for those of y'all that don't understand, is the fact that you've been exposed to the path to a realm of knowledge, and you've just said, meh, that's cool. I've been good this long without it. I'll be good the rest of the time. That doesn't mean it does not exist. All right? like another prime example, we were talking before the show about the fire pits in Pennsylvania. You're getting ready to go down to Pennsylvania, not to explore the fire pits, things like that.
Right.
But the reason I bring that up is because people like the Smithsonian are fully aware of the fact that we have found fire pits, folks. This is like layers of charcoal, like a foot or so deep with compacted red earth around it, which means like there have not only been one fire, but numerous fires and hot, hot, hot fires, like fires hot enough to cook pottery, things like that, you know, to kiln things. And they go back further than the known history of people in, or at least the current theories of when people came to North America, specifically the area of Pennsylvania. But that doesn't mean that those pits don't exist. That doesn't mean that the things that they found don't exist.
When we talk about,
it's just not the norm.
Professions of, yeah, and when you talk about which professions are the most narrow-minded, I think the archaeologists are at the front of the line because they really, you know, they really don't like to have their minds changed. Mm. And the reality is, you know, when you think about how little of the ground beneath our feet has been examined via an archaeological dig, it's just a minuscule amount.
Yeah.
Because obviously it takes a lot of time and there's so much land. So to just say the only evidence we're going to look at is archaeological evidence, it's like, oh my gosh, you're only looking at, you know, 0.00000001% of all the land, and you're going to use that to determine everything? You can't just look at archaeology. You have to look at, again, cartography and architecture and religion, all the different pieces of evidence,
anecdotal evidence. You know, the fact that hey, when the people who have occupied the land for the last few hundred years before you got there tell you, we didn't build it. We came
right.
here and it was there. Like, that's not how we roll. We don't build those things. We live in wigwams.
Well,
like,
and
we're ready
and
to pack up and move wherever the herd goes.
Yeah, and that gets into some cultural bias too, because the Native Americans have a very rich oral history. Mm. They pass it down. They cherish it. It's passed
almost
down very
an
carefully.
Unchanged oral history because of how sacred it is.
Exactly. We prefer our history written, and they do theirs oral. That's fine. But we look at that and we think of when we were at our first grade birthday party playing that game. Telephone, where I whisper in your ear, or you whisper in the next yep. person's ear, some message. By the time it comes all the way back around, it's all garbled. And so we think, oh well, that's what happens when the Native Americans pass their oral history down. And again, that's biased of us to assume that they can't pass it down more carefully. They're not first graders at a birthday party.
Yeah.
These are tribal elders taking things more seriously than that. And so we need to take what they say more seriously than we do. But they say, yes, the Templars were here. This is a Wampanoag tribal chief that I've become friendly with. Yes, the Templars were here. They built the Newport Tower. They carved the Western Knight. This is our oral history. He's gone on record to say that. After a long time of, he wasn't ready to do that right away. They don't necessarily trust us.
No, I don't understand why. I'm trying to figure out why, David. Why don't they trust us?
Yeah, but now finally he's come out and said it's time to go on record with that.
Absolutely.
And so he has. So, but that's another piece to add to the pile of evidence that's growing, year after year, that indicates something was going on here before Columbus. There was Europeans here, some kind of people were here doing things, carving, building, whatever. Unless you think the Native Americans, unless you think the Indians spoke runic and had iron tools, then they didn't carve those rune stones. So somebody had to do it.
Yeah. Well, and even to go a step further, like one of the prime examples I give people all the time of the quote history, I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, and don't get me wrong, I love my bingo nights, I love my fish fries, I love hanging out with my fellow knights and having a drink or two, viva Jesu, guys, but it's one of those, one of my favorite conversations is like, Columbus never actually made it here, right? Like here, he may have made it to the Bahamas, but that's kind of like saying that whoever discovered Guam discovered America.
It's the equivalent of the Norse being on the up in northern Newfoundland.
Yeah.
So they're technically part of the continent, but they really didn't get into the continental U.S. in any way.
Yeah.
Neither group probably. I've always been of the opinion, when I was a kid, I used to watch Star Trek with my father, and what's that say, to seek out new life and new civilization, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
That's right.
So I've always thought that ancient peoples who were explorers, we know the ancient Phoenicians were amazing navigators and navigated by the stars. They built boats bigger than twice the size of Columbus. They were circumnavigating Africa.
Yeah.
They were sailing up from through the Mediterranean, out the Straits of Gibraltar, up to the North Sea, up to England to get tin at Cornwall to bring back to make bronze.
Yep.
So they were probably exploring, and maybe they crossed the Atlantic on purpose, or maybe they just got blown off course during a storm. But I've always believed that they crossed the Atlantic probably 3,000 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
I think they're the ones who built the site in, I don't know if Dennis Stone mentioned this when he was on talking about his site at America Stonehenge, but I've always thought the Phoenicians were the builders of the America Stonehenge site in southern New Hampshire. There's lots of evidence that sort of dates things right around the Phoenician, right around 3,000 years ago during the Phoenician Empire.
Absolutely. And there's of course the story from the Smithsonian, like they sent an archaeologist out to the Grand Canyon who found the cave full of Phoenician mm-hmm. artifacts, things like
right,
that.
Right.
And of course there's the stone writing out in Western America, all that kind of stuff. So and there has been the long held theory that this is where the Ark of the Covenant came. This is where it was taken and hidden.
It's funny you say that, Chris, because I've I've written about this in sort of fictionally that it would be
powdered
interesting
gold.
If it was here. Exactly. Good job. And I'm in the process of writing a book now, and for the first time came across some Cherokee legends. Legends of the Cherokee had the Ark of the Covenant. I had never come across this until about this week, and then you just mentioned it for the second time this week. It's coming. Where did you hear it was in America? Was it the Cherokee legend, the same thing I just said, or was something totally different?
Oh, no. I mean, there has been the, my Lord, where was it? I'm trying to remember. I want to say it was, hold on. I will try to bring it up on screen.
Yeah.
Because
we can do it off.
Because, it literally is just amazing to know that they're, let's see, Phoenician writing, North America. If you Google that, that should bring it up, folks.
That wouldn't necessarily bring up Ark of the Covenant, but you know what, Chris, this ties in really nicely to what you were talking about with the Oak Island, the Curse of Oak Island show, which I do watch religiously, and the idea of the Templar treasure. Because when we talk about the Templar treasure, we should also talk about the temple treasure. There's two things. One is the treasures of the Templars, and one is the treasures underneath the temple of Solomon that they found. And when we talk about those, think back to all the things that we know about from the Old Testament: the Ark of the Covenant, the Rod of Aaron, the Ten Commandments, something called the Tables of Testimony, the Pot of Manna. There's all this stuff that was
the possible
about,
manna machine.
The manna machine, the Ark of the Covenant, yeah. The stuff that was kept in the Holy of Holies. All of that has been lost to history. Where is all that stuff? And, you know, some of it potentially was lost. Some of it's probably hidden, maybe, I don't know, in Roslyn Chapel, maybe the Ark of the Covenant's in Ethiopia. But you mentioned maybe the Ark of the Covenant is here. Where's the golden menorah? We know it was paraded through the streets of Rome after the King Herod's war in 72 AD or whatever, but since then it's been lost. You know, where is that? Is it in the Vatican archives? I mean, so all these fascinating treasures, both the temple treasures and the Templar treasures, both of those things, you know, I'm not saying that they're up at Oak Island, but the possibilities of all of those things potentially being in North America, they have to be somewhere. So, you know, it makes sense that where better place to hide things back in the 1300s than across the ocean, which many people believed was unsafe to cross. You know, that's a great hiding place if you're the Templars and you got a fleet of ships and you know how to get across and no one else does.
And for those of you who may think like, there's no evidence of, you know, like people from that part of the world, like Middle East, hopping over to North America, then explain to me how they find coca leaves inside of Egyptian mummies. Cause you know, they only grow in one place.
Which
either means people from South America went to Egypt and were trading, or people from Egypt came to South America. One of the two. It's not rocket math. They only grow in one region of the world. You can't exactly grow coca leaves in Mesopotamia. It just doesn't work. And when you're talking about the Ark of the Covenant, I'm trying to remember which mountain range it was that is referred to in the Bible, which basically translates to here in America, where they talk about it being one of the last possible resting places. I'll have to look it up because it just crossed my mind as you were grilling me a second ago about where did I hear about that. It's wild to know that. Yeah, there's a whole theory about the lost tribe of Israel coming over to Western America. That's part of what Brigham Young was chasing whenever he went out.
Yeah, and so And so the way I stumbled upon this legend of the Cherokee having potentially having the Ark of the Covenant, and let's be clear, we're speculating right now. I do not have evidence for that.
No.
You know, other things, I have evidence that the Templars were here. I have evidence that the Phoenicians are here. I have no evidence that the Ark of the Covenant is here. But I've read some interesting speculation about it, and the line of speculation goes as follows. The Cherokee believe that they... Their ancient origin was from across what they call the Sunrise Sea, the Atlantic Ocean. Unlike other Indians, they don't believe they came across the Bering Land Strait. And so we sort of poo-poo them all. You don't know your own history. Well, yes, they do. And so they believe that. And so they've been doing, especially the eastern band of Cherokee, most of the Cherokee are out in Oklahoma, but some of them did not do the Trail of Tears march, and they stayed in Appalachia. Sort of western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, and the east, that's the eastern band. And they've done DNA testing to the extent they believe that they are the descendants of one of the tribes of Israel. They've actually changed their tribal patch to include the Jewish star, the Israeli flag as part of their patch, as part of their insignia. But they believe, based on DNA evidence, that they descend from ancient Jews. And so that's one of the reasons why this Ark of the Covenant thing sort of resonated with me, is because I knew about the DNA. And then when somebody said, well, the Cherokee have a legend that they have the Ark of the Covenant, well, that would potentially, you know, at least there's a story that holds water that you can look to there that would explain how that would happen. And you talked about the lost tribe. It's the same thing. It's like at some point somebody came across for whatever reason, and that's how it would have come over. But again, this is speculation, but it's fun speculation, you know.
It's amazing speculation based on once again the anecdotal history of a people, as well as a few loosely found artifacts. You know, I know that there was the Tablet of Phoenician Writing that was found in Western America. Like I said, once again, it was an article from the Smithsonian back in the day that talked about the find of the cave of Phoenician artifacts.
In the 1920s, familiar with that article. And there's also some strong evidence about the Phoenicians being in the Great Lakes region. There's a carving of a Phoenician ship. There is a lot of anecdotal a lot of testimony from early colonists who went out there and immediately noticed that copper, flow copper, had been extracted. Somebody did carbon dating on one of the timbers that were used in one of the mines, copper mines, and it came back 3,000 years old. And the Native Americans, when asked about it, said, ancient people came here to trade for and to mine copper. So when you think about, you know, when would you need copper? That would have been during the Bronze Age. Yep. To make bronze, you need copper and tin. We know the tin, I mentioned earlier, the Phoenicians were sailing to England to get tin at Cornwall. Where were they getting copper? No one's quite sure where all the copper came from. There were some copper mines in Europe and in Africa, but not nearly enough, because bronze is 90% plus copper and only 10% or less tin. So you need a lot more copper. So and the copper, again, in the Great Lakes region just basically floats. It just sits there. It's very pure. Well, it's by far the best place to get copper in the world. So if the Phoenicians had found their way over here, however, it would make sense that they would have kept coming back and forth, and also that they would have needed a base of operations along the East Coast, which is the America Stonehenge site in New Hampshire.
They may have been ancient, and this is something that we talk about on this show regularly, especially with people like Stephen Myers from PharaohsPumpFoundation.org, stuff like that. Ancient people were not idiots. Okay, people?
Exactly.
They weren't. Just because they were using stone tools doesn't mean they were momos, all right? They understood things. They knew things. They knew the cost and expenditure of something. They knew that if you found a source of this rare metal and it was worth the expenditure of, let's say, death, let's say, what have you, for literally what it cost at that time period. If it cost 10 ships and you had 85, hey, it may be worth 10 ships to go over there and get that copper, you know? But I've got it up from EOS.org right now where miners left a pollution trail in the Great Lakes 6,000 years ago. 6,000 years ago, these people were mining for copper in the Great Lakes region.
Well, that's further back than I knew. There is really strong evidence of it. There's a shipwreck called the Uluburu shipwreck off the coast of Turkey, I believe, in the Mediterranean, that has ancient copper of a purity that is only found in the Great Lakes region. So you have to wonder how a ship in the Mediterranean would have copper from the Great Lakes unless it was being traded, you know, back and forth. So
there's
hard evidence that indicates this happened.
There is the wild evidence, of course, of the sword, the Viking sword that was found in Minnesota out in the field. All kinds of things like that where, they were obviously coming over. Things like that.
Right.
It was not a rarity.
Right, that's later than the Phoenicians. So we're talking about the Vikings. We're talking the Norse from the 11th century or a little later, the Kensington Runestone Party, which was 1362. But this goes back to what I said earlier. I think the Phoenicians are probably the first group that came over. But I think once you've kicked down that door, I think back and forth periodically, whether it was the Celts, whether it was the Welsh, whether it was the Norse, whether it was whoever it might have been, the Scots, the Templars, again, there was economic opportunity to come back and forth. And you mentioned earlier, it might cost you 10 ships. And so you wouldn't do it regularly. You have to have a particular reason for it. You'd probably do it periodically. You wouldn't be doing it every month. But
you had no power. You had no sales. Quite possibly, it may have been a 6 month journey, one way.
Right, and
to go get the material.
At some point, you might have figured out that if you got blown off course around the Cape of the Horn of Africa, and you got blown off course and ended up in Brazil, then you can come up the coastline and sort of follow the trade winds, and you could do it all that way. Which later on, people figured out, but the ancients might have figured that out as well. So, and then it goes back to a time when the Atlantic Ocean, during the last ice age, 12,000 years ago, was the water level was much lower because everything was frozen, and so there were probably islands. The shorelines were much closer together. It would have been a lot easier to cross the Atlantic. Again, 12,000 to 15,000 years ago. This goes back to what you're talking about in Pennsylvania. How long have humans been in North America? It goes back a lot further than we used to think. And this all goes into something called the Solutrean theory, where not all Indians came across the Bering Land Strait. Some of them came across the Atlantic from the Iberian Peninsula, probably during the Ice Age when water levels were much lower in the Atlantic.
Absolutely, absolutely. And to know that there are people like you out there, not just exploring these possibilities, but putting these possibilities into the realm of actual possibility, making sure that they see the light of day, making sure that at least scholars are aware of the situation. and it's kind of sad because recently I had a guest who I approached for this show, Doc. I was telling you before the show, I'm a big fan of, and this is, I mean, I'm a big fan of the Amazon Great Sources Great Courses series. It's phenomenal.
Right.
It's great. And one of the people that I started watching was this professor who, oddly enough, it was all about Mayan culture and ancient American civilization, the mound builders, things like that. And oddly enough, he was from the University of Texas. And I contacted him to be on this show. And we since became friends via email, like via video handshake, or digital handshake, we became friends. Because I invited him to be on the show, and he's like, I don't think what I have to say about Mayan civilization or the mound builders in America would necessarily be okay with your audience. And I was like, well, okay, I can appreciate that. Because, you know, we talk about a lot of things like this. We've, of course, had L.A. Marzulli on. He has a totally different take on what's going on in New Hampshire. He's talking about Nephilim and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, right.
Hey, I had a religious, more than one religious experience in my life. That doesn't discount the fact that it's a possibility and that it actually happened just because I'm the only witness. You know, and we got into this big back and forth for a few days email wise about the communities between his community of academia and how they might view him coming on a show like this. How the communities even of what we are involved in, David, and how they would view his message of what he's bringing on. And I was like, I assure you, Doctor, like, number one, I've been listening to your podcast and I love it. It's great. His podcast is amazing. Go check it out, folks. It's the Mayan Research Center here in Austin. Amazing, amazing work going on there and great, great podcast material. And one of those that, like I told you before the show, my goal is to demystify. I want to rabbit hole. Yeah, I want to throw things against the wall. I got no problem with that. But much like you, without the scientific evidence, without the proof of where it points, we're hearsay and conjecture. And we can hear, the cool thing about science is you're allowed to theorize anything you want. Literally. I could theorize that the sky is actually green and our corneas cannot see that wavelength. Now, what we need, or actually I can hypothesize that, and then what I need is theorem to prove the hypothesis. So, like, that's the cool thing about science is technically you're allowed to think about anything. You're allowed to take in any possibility. The question is, do we, and are we willing to? Are we willing to look at and like those crazy people in the 1500s that sailed around the world, you know, that were like, no, don't do that. You'll fall off. Well, let's find out. You want to fund the mission? Like, at the very least, you're going to fund the mission of my suicide, and that'll be newsworthy. You know, like, but you got to be willing to do it. And you got to be willing to let that exist and be there. And even if it's a quote hanging chad, you know, where I don't know, that's a mystery. Okay.
What you just said there, Chris, might be the most important thing we talked about it all tonight, which is the willingness to say I don't know, it's a mystery, and this is where. This is where my training as an attorney really leaves me disappointed in academia because they just insist that they have all the answers when the truth is every time we turn around, whether it's how long have humans been in North America or what's the age of civilization. We used to think it was, you know, Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent 6,000 years ago. Oops, it's Göbekli Tepe 12,000 years ago. We were wrong by a factor of two. And, oh, we used to think it was Columbus. Well, no, maybe it's not Columbus. It's obviously people before that. And just how often we're wrong and yet how we still remain, when I say we, I'm talking about our academic leaders, remain unwilling to open their minds to possibilities that they might be wrong again. And that, to me, that just, it's not really hypocritical as much as it is stubborn and it shows, and I used this expression earlier, a lack of intellectual rigor. And that just really bothers me.
As somebody who my audience knows, you know, I spent my first year in college in the seminary. And man, there is a danger in dogma. There is danger in dogma in that it does not allow for growth, spiritual growth, period. It allows you to stymie you know, because you are stuck in such a mentality that you cannot move past, or that your boundary of belief does not let you move past. And that's where we get into our modern society and the issues in it, and why this show even started, my friend, is that there is this quantifiable issue in people's minds of just confirmation bias.
And I love that term. Yes.
Quite literally the fact of something that you have just learned so breaks your paradigm of thought that you can't even imagine your world without your paradigm of thought. So you just dismiss it. Now, it may be a thought form, it may be an idea, it may be a hypothesis, you know, but you got to be willing to hypothesize. You got to be ready to hypothesize. And when you're not willing and ready to hypothesize with the information given, that's when you get into a dogmatic situation. That's when you get into this is because it is, and this is because it's what we've been told.
The half of our brain that is faith-based is not the half of the brain that we should be using to make intellectual decisions, because those are in conflict. You know, left brain, right brain, however you want to call it.
And that is not to dismiss faith. Once again, my audience knows this is the first time I've ever told you, but half the reason I have people like Sev talk on who communicates with extra-dimensional beings, people like Terry Loveless, who has experienced UFO experiences, stuff like that. Like I said, I spent my first year in college because I felt the presence of God and felt Him call me to serve. You could call me just as crazy, but that is my experience and my realm of experience, and you will never tell me that it didn't exist and happen. Because it existed and it happened. Now the question is, how does the world fit into that experience for me? And how do I interpret the world because of that experience? You know? And you have to be willing to put that experience aside sometimes and look at things, and literally, like you were saying earlier, let the facts and let the evidence lead you where they will lead you, and just be okay with it. Be okay with it. If it crushes your paradigm, all right, remember, your like 50-year paradigm is nothing in comparison to the paradigm of the world and humanity. It's like, we've been here, well, at least most folks will tell you at least 10,000 years as society. So, you know, yeah, like 50 years ain't nothing, Jack, if you think you knew something, you know?
Yep, that's a good cherry on top for our conversation tonight, Chris.
Absolutely.
I know we're getting near the end here. So,
well, I want to thank you for your time this evening. You are more than welcome to come back on the show. I would love to. I'd love to, especially get into the topic of Ark of the Covenant, powdered gold. What was in the Ark of the Covenant? What the Ark of the Covenant was? Things like that. Like, this has been an amazing conversation, not just during the show, but pre-show. And I want to thank you for your time tonight. I want to thank you for stretching your mental legs with us the way that you have to discuss these things. And before we let you go, it is one last time for shameless self-promotion, David. Please do let people know where they can go, other than the Dudes and Beer store, to find your books, to find your Audible stuff, what have you. Give everything to them.
Thank you, Chris, and I really appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate what you do with the show, opening people's minds. You mentioned you almost went into religious service, but this is God's work, opening people's minds.
Darn tootin', bud. This was my calling.
Good stuff. So my easiest place to find my books is a whole series called The Templars in America. There's 11 books in this series. They are fiction, but they're fiction based in fact. I call them faction books. So essentially, is they're modern day thrillers, but they turn on these real sites and these real artifacts and the real history. And in fact, the books, even though they're fiction, they include pictures of the artifacts within the story. There are research notes at the end. So it's really a combination of a history book and a thriller in the genre of Ken Follett or Dan Brown, something like that. So it really, these books are designed for people who are history buffs but who like to be on the roller coaster ride while they're learning. So trust me, there'll be plenty of information, plenty of facts, but again, you'll have a little bit of a thrill ride along with that information being given to you. This is just the way I like to write. So Amazon, davidbrodybooks.com. The books are available in both paperback and in Kindle format. The first three are also available on Audible. I keep them relatively inexpensive because I want them to be available for people. I want people to read them. I want people to interact with me. I want people to call me up and say, hey, I've got a Templar cross in my backyard. Come take a look at it. This is why I do this. You can tell that I'm very passionate about it, and again, I hope other people who are interested in history, especially the sort of untold history of North America, will jump on board and go on the ride with me on this.
Amen to that. And I'm here to tell you, I have no Templar cross in my backyard, but I still want you to come look at it, David.
You got it, Chris. Next
this,
time I'm in
this
Austin,
conversation
buddy,
pre-show
with me,
and on air.
And I'll take that beer that we talked about earlier. So.
Anytime. My family is from the Massachusetts. My wife's family is from the Massachusetts area. I guarantee you we can make that happen, my friend. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you are online checking out all the great work of David S. Brody, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer store. That's where you can find all of our guest books. That's where you can find all the great stuff from all the guests at Dudes and Beer. Make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com/app to get that new app right there in your pocket on your Android device. Sorry, Orchard Dwellers, it will be coming to you soon. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.